Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Hello, welcome back to another episode of Movies, Films, and Flicks. I'm your host, John Lossow. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Hey guys, I had a terrible day. I gotta tell you about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so my wife and I, we were driving our brand new Jeep Grand Cherokee through the deserts of New Mexico.
Right.
And, or somewhere. Yeah. And so Midwest, maybe, who knows, maybe, you know, Northwest. It could be anywhere. And so we're
just
driving.
Like,
and
describe like the four cardinal directions right there. You're somewhere.
We did a lot of driving today.
Yeah.
And so this redneck, you know, I accidentally cut him off. He got all mad, you know, some road rage, whatever. And later when we were pumping gas, he came by, started some junk with me, you know, and we got separated. I went to the bathroom, came back, and we took off, and then our car broke down, and we didn't really know what it was, and so then this trucker comes up. He's like, hey, I'm really friendly. Oh, there's a gas station up a mile road. And my wife is like, you know what? I'll just hop in. And, you know, he seemed like a nice fellow. So she jumped in and they drove off. But they never came back.
Was the trucker JT Walsh?
Yeah. He looked just like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I sit there and I open up the hood of my new Jeep Grand Cherokee. And I discover that they just messed with my battery. So I plugged it back in, went driving, and went to this diner. I was like, hey, have you guys seen my wife? You know, she's supposed to be here. And they're like, no, we haven't seen her. So, like, let me through this crazy, like, cat and mouse, like, paranoid. I'm all sweaty. I'm getting gross. I shot a guy. You know, this stupid truck ends up. But it is funny, though. I rescue my wife, right? And the JT Walsh lookalike. We end up throwing him off a cliff. Then we jump out of a truck just in time. And then the truck lands on him. So, I mean, he got what he you know, deserved. But, you know, now my Jeep Grand Cherokee is kind of destroyed. And it was brand new. So, you know, we're going to have to talk to insurance tomorrow and possibly the police when they find out what happened.
Wow.
I almost don't want to reveal to the listeners what that huge reference is to.
It's actually an extended commercial for Jeep Grand Cherokee. It's always an adventure wherever you go. Right, Mark?
Yeah. It'll never break down.
Exactly. Well, thank you for that, Mark.
Yeah.
And my other co-host, John Lovingood.
Yeah, how's it going? You know, on a much simpler note, to our listeners out there, I work actually basically on the Mexican border at the very bottom tip of Texas. And so you don't see a lot of your standard American pop culture on the T-shirts down here. And as I was driving, I was right before the port where you would leave to go through to Mexico. And I saw this dude crossing the street wearing a shirt. And I thought, oh, damn, he's wearing a Jaws shirt. And it made me think of Mark. But then I got closer to him and I realized it's not a Jaws shirt. It was like a Jaws shirt. And then on the print, they replaced the shark with a kitten. And it said, instead of Jaws, it said Paws. But then, like, it still had the person swimming at the surface of the water. I'm just thinking, like, what's this giant kitten doing under the water?
I feel like that kitten would hate it. I feel like that kitten would hate it down there.
You ever seen
and the
a
kitten
cat
didn't
in
even
water?
Look wet. Like, it had water-retardant hairs.
You ever seen cats in water? They start freaking out, man.
Yeah. You know, that's when I saw this random shirt, and I see no movie shirts down here, and I saw that. I thought that was kind of cool.
I'm honored that you saw a Jaws shirt and thought about me. Like, I want to be that guy. Like, you know, like, there's that guy that wears that hat. Whenever you see that hat, like, there's that guy. Like, I want people to think of Jaws and go, hey, Mark, Jaws. And I go, yeah.
You know, I know you're joking, but I really do want to see a Paws movie now. Where like it's just like a little baby kitten, and it's just like every time it's about to pounce on you, like John Williams' classic score, like starts coming, dun dun, then little kitten just like pounces on you.
It's just so adorable that like you let it get too close and it kills you. You know they should have replaced that swimming woman on the water surface with a little rowboat filled with balls of yarn.
Is that how you distract the kitten? Like you just instead of like you know how they shot Jaws with the barrels to see where it was, you just throw out bars of yarn,
yeah.
And then like from the water, you just see a little paw batting at the yarn. adorable.
Dude, that movie will make millions.
Yeah, guarantee it. And I'm not alone today. Today I am accompanied by Yellow Edition Red Bull.
Right.
Red Bull, we are still awaiting your checks for sponsorship.
Also, is that like, what's yellow? Is that like banana?
It's mango, it's like, pineapple.
It's pineapple.
And wait, everything else does good.
Lazabeth.
Yeah.
Lazabeth, you said it's mango?
Yeah, just mango flavor. It's not just mango.
Like, oh.
It's tropical. That's all you need to know.
It's pineapple flavored Red Bull served to you in a hollowed out mango.
You have like you have to drink it really quick, otherwise it gets really gross.
Yeah, Red Bull doesn't it gets really all pulpy. Sit too well. All right, I think it's time to start the podcast like we always do with listener questions. Mark, I think you got a couple questions from us from actually.
Yeah, well, these are from my good friend Donnie Brewski. And sorry to interrupt, Lazabeth. And Donnie Brewski, he wrote us this on Facebook. And Donnie Brewski and I were in a famous band called the Brewskis out there in Tallahassee, Florida, FSU. And
can you give us a – I already know the answer, but can you give us the name of your most famous song?
Light Beers Don't Matter Much.
Yes.
That's a catchy title. That sounds like something Toby Keith would do.
Well, we ripped off a song called by Lucero called My Tears Don't Matter Much. And we had a song. It's like – one of the things, and so I was a singer, it was like, oh, man, what is it? Oh, gosh, it's Miller Lite tastes like watered down water. I'd get more drunk than Evian, so that was good. And then, we had a couple more. We had Rambo as an asshole. We had A Vampire Drank My Blood and She Got Drunk. We had High Kick City.
Yeah. Well, didn't High Kick City... you always like threw out the high kick, right?
Yeah, and I would throw it into the crowd, and one time I connected.
Oh,
you know, that should be the theme song for Roadhouse 3.
Yep, it's working in the city, working 9 to 5. Gotta watch your back because it's hard to survive. We're in a high kick city. High kick.
I picture like Sean William Scott singing that with his eyes closed, like he's really into it.
Dude, he would nail it. I remember one show I used to throw out chicken wings to the crowd, and about a half hour went by, and a chicken wing came flying back, and I was really drunk by then because that was our whole band thing. I would drink a beer between each thing. I remember I caught the chicken wing with one hand, and Matt, you guys met, he's one of the groomsmen at the wedding, Matt, I went to take a bite of the chicken, and I remember him going, "Noo!" And I took a bite, and everybody in the audience went, "Ew!"
So let me get this straight. Like, you took a bite of a chicken wing that came flying in from parts unknown.
Yes, you were
just,
I did.
You were just so drunk and hungry.
Yep. And everybody went, "No!" And then I thought I was going to die for like the next month. I didn't get sick or anything, but I was like, I have to have something. And
I can just imagine you waking up every morning. It's like, oh, today's the day. Today's the day.
And then one time I got so drunk, like I got so sick of being on stage, I threw a temper tantrum and I stormed off the stage. But everyone's like, "That Mitch Brewski is so rock and roll." So everyone thought I was still in character, but I was still like me, and I was just drunk and belligerent. So everyone's like, "Man, Mitch is really sticking to it." And but it was just me being annoyed.
Oh, didn't you also wear the wig and the trucker hat, right? When you were Mitch Brewski, you went all out.
We actually shot shotgun holes through my shirt. And like it said I got shot in Nam, and I did a bunch of fake tattoos, and I had a huge tattoo on my forearm that just said "fart" from Raised in Arizona.
The legend of
Mitch Brewski. With all that lunacy, I'll bet that if you had actually eaten that while you were drunk, and you ate that rogue chicken wing, you would have caught wolf cop lycanthropy.
I just turned into a werewolf. Oh. I bet I probably like. What would a good song be that? So we got Wolf Cop, then we got Teen Wolf. What would be like a Wolf Pop? No, that's I think that's a.
Yeah.
Let's see, Wolf. I don't know. I can't think of nothing right now. But yeah,
it's one of those.
Maybe as the show goes on, we'll think of something good.
Yeah, probably not. All right, so Donnie had a question.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Donnie. And see what you do, Donnie.
Wait, what instrument did Donnie play real quick?
What's up?
What did he play?
Guitarist, and he was also our bassist. And he kept changing characters. So his first show, he was like this really emo guy.
Yeah.
And like too many like women in the crowd liked him. legit. And then he switched to like a Kangol jumpsuit wearing type guy.
Okay. Oh, poor Donnie. Too many girls like me.
Yeah. Did you play the harpsichord?
I tried.
It's hard to high kick while you're holding a harp.
Yeah, no. I mean, I tried, but I got my foot stuck in it, and then it just got ugly, and like, yeah. You know, my ankle exploded.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to sing a Bruce song, but I'm not going to do it.
We'll never get to the listener question. That poor listener, he's just listening with bated breath.
All right, so the
well,
first
listen,
question
Donnie sounds like an upright wait. Guy, like an upstanding guy, so he can wait.
Yeah, no, like, yeah, so what, yeah, so what? I just want to talk about the brewskis, but I know we have to get off of this.
Yeah.
So when we talk about beer fests and strange brew, we'll bring up the brewskis.
Yeah.
But so the first question is, what is Tommy from Tommy Boy up to nowadays? And I guess it's applicable because we've been writing a lot about 95, and that movie took place 20 years ago.
Okay, quick recap. All right, Tommy Boy, who is played by Chris Farley, he inherited his dad's auto parts business, right?
Yep.
Okay. So what is he doing now?
Oh, and that was back when Rob Lowe was still playing douchebags instead of those really nice, likable characters in the West Wing and yep. Parks and Recreation and shit.
So I think he did really good with the company. He gave it over to David Spade. He married that one woman. And then they had Jonah Hill from Superbad.
That's his dad?
Yeah. Like, you know, kind of saucy. Like, it took him 7 years to get through college. This kid's kind of a partier. He has some weird tics to him.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I think... No, for some reason I see Tommy from Tommy Boy, like, yeah, you know, he's a dad, may or may not be the father of Jonah Hill, who knows, but I could see him just kind of, you know, being older, probably the same size, and he's still kind of clumsy, like he's always like tripping over something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He's wrecked everything in his house.
Yeah. I don't know.
No, yeah,
it's been a while since I've seen Tommy Boy, to be completely honest. I don't know. It's like Tommy Boy, like, Black Sheep, all those Chris Farley movies. It's been forever since I've seen
them. I like to imagine that he hit a real downward spiral. Maybe he was drinking or some kind of like gambling addiction or something. And then he went and saw like a couple of Tony Robbins seminars to get his confidence back up. And then he turned into the van down by the river.
Oh, yeah.
Guy from SNL. Like, even though that was before, like, Tommy Boy, I want to think that that's what Tommy Boy ended up as. Like, that guy telling those stories like he knows better than you. And how you're going to end up, like, living in a van down by the river.
But I think he'd be really successful because he was actually a pretty good salesman.
Yeah.
And, like, he actually failed his way up. And actually, your cousin and I, John Ryan, Living Good, he and I used to sit there and talk about Tommy Boy, and every time something would go wrong, we would always go, oh, my God.
No, Ryan and I still do that. We still do that now.
Like,
oh, my God.
And they're like, you're so pathetic. I'm just going to, like, give you chicken wings. Hey, speaking of chicken wings, they cooked him chicken wings.
What?
Remember when he was like, hey, can I get some, like, oh, didn't he want, like, shrimp or something like that? And they said they're not cooking anymore. So he's like, I'll just eat some packets of sugar. And then he made, like, this really pathetic speech. And that lady was like, all right, I'll have the cook start up the oven.
I haven't seen this movie in maybe 20 years.
Yeah, no, seriously.
I don't remember.
I'm John Blank here. I'm just taking your word for it, Mark.
That's 100% true.
Okay.
Put it in the books, guy. Put it in the books.
I'm writing it down right now.
Hey. Living Good.
If it's inaccurate, Chris Farley can call us and call you out on it.
Really?
Too soon?
John, put it in the accurate movie file.
I'll get around on.
That's literally filled with everything else about that we talk about.
Yeah. Accurate movie file. Like it's an actual filing cabinet. It's not like electronic or it's not like a database or anything. Like there's index cards and everything.
Do you file it or just throw stuff in there?
A little bit of both.
Do you have a question about a movie I saw within the last 20 years?
I do.
It's another one from Donnie, right?
Yo, another one from Donnie Brewski. So that reminds me of the story. No, I'm joking. So the next one is, you can tell he listens to us because this is a question. He wrote, who would win in a fight, The Rock and Scorpion King or Kurt Russell and Soldier?
Okay, I have two answers to that. But the first answer is because I misunderstood the question. At first, I thought it was Kurt Russell from Soldier versus The Rock as the Scorpion King, I was thinking of The Mummy Returns. Yeah. So, like, so I think that Kurt Russell in Soldier would beat CGI The Rock Scorpion King from The Mummy Returns, but he could never beat non-CGI The Rock from The Scorpion King.
Why do you think – why could he defeat Mr. CGI?
Because that thing was dumb, man. If you look back at the CGI, like back when we saw that and we didn't know better, like, that was pretty cool. It didn't, you know, it looked a little off of The Rock, you know, his face. It looked, it was so blatant CGI, but it was still cool at the time. Whereas, like, now when I look back at that scene, it is horrible. It's like, it's like 8-bit Nintendo versus a new gaming system.
Yeah. Yeah,
that movie crushed. And Lazavath, remember one time you said that there was a sequel you watched that made you realize that sequels kind of suck? Sometimes. Like, you realize that movies could be bad. Does that make sense? Remember?
I said that, but I don't remember which sequel it was. I've seen a lot of bad sequels since I've said that.
We'll look in the file cabinet during the break and we'll figure it out.
All right, I'll get right on.
But like, that's why he beat CGI. But the real one, though, the real Rock. I mean, that's the Rock. I mean, you know how, you know, bullies will hold the little kid away, like, by putting their palm on their head and straightening out their arm, like they're stiff arm. The Rock could do that with his pec to Kurt Russell.
See, I'm going the opposite way because I watch these clips, right? I watch the Soldier clips, and then I watch the Scorpion King clips. And the first big battle with the Rock, he's charging into battle, right? And all he's doing is yelling, and he runs into battle with his arm above his head and his sword kind of leaning backwards. Like, that's very – it's not good strategery. I'm going to use that word. It's not good. And I was watching him in that battle, and he's throwing these really wide sword strikes. He's leaving himself open. He's getting a little cocky. He's just making grunt noises. He's like, ugh, and then he's leaving himself open on both ends. So I watched a Soldier fight, and I'm watching Kurt Russell in that. And, like, he really took advantage of the openings. So he was out-muscled. But he had moments where he would, like, there's a scene where he looks down at this scythe. I think it's like a scythe or a blade. And the guy he's fighting looks down at it. So you think, oh, hey, Kurt Russell's going after that blade. But when the guy looks down on it, Kurt Russell takes a helicopter blade and slices the dude's chest. So, like, he takes the openings that are given to him. He knows, like, jiu-jitsu. He's hitting hard, and he can take a punch. Like, he gets slammed through everything that you can get slammed through. He's like Roddy Piper in They Live. And he just keeps coming back. He keeps trunking. So I think in this fight against the Scorpion King, the Rock would get a little cocky. He couldn't knock him out. Then he would get a little worried that the guy's not going anywhere. Then he would get a, you know, then Kurt Russell would pull a shaky little move when the Scorpion King puts his hands up in the air. I think Soldier Kurt Russell could do it.
Okay.
No, but what about CGI The Rock?
Where he's
like a centaur but with a scorpion body.
I think Kurt Russell would ride him into battle.
But when he gets stung by the giant scorpion tail,
they could just sting him in the back with its tail.
That wouldn't bother Kurt Russell.
It's like a little to the left. Oh, yeah, that's a spot.
I can imagine Kurt Russell's like, oh, man, is it time for my acupuncture appointment already?
Like, didn't he have snakes in Soldier? Weren't there, like, poisonous snakes that Kurt Russell was just like, yeah, whatever.
He killed a snake that was going for the little mute boy.
Yeah, so
deaf boy or something.
He's not worried about poisonous things.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Here's how I imagine the fight going. Kurt Russell from Soldier and The Rock from The Scorpion King, pre-CGI. It's a close fight. They go hand-to-hand. You know, it started out with weapons, but, you know how these manly fights go. It always devolves to hand-to-hand fights, and Kurt Russell gets the best of them. But then, as Kurt Russell is about to proclaim victory, The Rock morphs into CGI, like a scorpion, whatever. A la something out of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And then he kills Kurt Russell from Soldier.
Oh, Kurt Russell should have totally just formed the Megazord to fight
him. Then here's what happens. Here's what happens. The Stargate, that's like right to the side of the fight. It opens up, and then like Kurt Russell from Stargate comes in and then like just kills, The Rock.
Dude, and that's full circle because the Stargate took them to that alternate universe, but there was like Egypt with Pharaoh.
Yeah. Yeah. See?
Man, no. my Like, my brain just melted, guys. I feel like it, and, like...
See, that's why CGI Rock lost, because he thought he killed Kurt Russell. But then there's no way. No. Kurt Russell is immortal. There's no way you can kill him.
So we had a double blood sport going on there. When the motorcycle guy is battling what's his name? I forgot the guy's name from Bloodsport, but the motorcycle guy thinks he won, so he starts cheering.
Yeah.
And then he gets
Donald Gibbs.
Donald Gibbs starts cheering, and then, you know, the guy gets up and does some peck bouncing and then kills him. Puts him in the hospital.
Yeah.
And stomps on his head.
So it's like a double blood sport.
Yeah. So Kurt Russell is the only person that could die and then kill you to finish you off.
By a Stargate.
Yeah.
I just had this vision of Kurt Russell flying out of that Stargate, riding one of those mammoths that are in the movie.
Yeah.
And just like mowing down CGI Scorpion Kick.
Stargate Kurt Russell was actually pretty jacked too.
Than a luck dragon.
Stargate Kurt Russell is pretty jacked, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't know. All right. So I think that answers those questions for now, right?
Yeah. Thanks, Donnie Brewski.
Actually, he's got another question too, but we'll answer that later. Because now it's time to move on to our first movie of the day. And let me good. I'm going to pass it off to you this time.
So we're going to start by talking about Insidious Chapter 3, which you can't really talk about without addressing the whole franchise, because it's Insidious Chapter 3, but they should have called it Insidious the Prologue, because
chapter
it takes
zero?
Place before Chapter 1.
Yeah.
Now, like, I don't know. A lot of people really seem to love these movies, and I'm not like a fan of these movies, but I think they're a lot of fun. I think they're great popcorn flicks. I think they capture tone and creepiness and build up fantastically across all three movies. But I'm not a fan of the storytelling in general. But this third movie, do we want to start all the way back at the beginning, Mark? Do you want to start at the dawn of Insidious, or do you want to start with Chapter 3?
I got a quick question for you.
Yeah, okay.
We're going to put this in the filing cabinet. I just want to know. So I'm reading your review. I think these Insidious movies are like a roller coaster built on top of a fun house that are on top of an active volcano. I just think they're pure delight of like jump scares. But in your review, I'm reading, you wrote, your review is kind of like a roller coaster, and I love it. But it says, it pains me, but doesn't shock me to say that in all endeavors, this film failed.
And then, no, in all those endeavors that I just mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Article.
And then at the end you wrote, upon further reflection, this will remain in my eyes an excellent scary night popcorn flick.
Right, yeah. When I'm saying in all those endeavors it failed, those endeavors were the storytelling, the characters, and getting me to care.
See, dude, just thinking, like, this sounds weird, but like thinking about Lin Shaye's character Elise in this film, kind of like it makes me like tear up a little bit. Like it does, and that's really weird.
She's got a pretty tragic little subplot going on, right?
Yeah, John, you want to explain the background, then we'll just work our way through the movies.
So this movie is our lead is Quinn, who's a teen girl who's helping her widowed, struggling father take care of her younger brother. So it's a family under some tough times, not unusual in these kinds of movies. And the backstory, she tried to contact her mother with a Ouija board or something and caught the attention of an evil spirit. Without knowing it. Then later, she contacts Elise, who's our psychic medium from all these franchise films. And Elise is hesitant to help her, but ultimately decides to help her. And Elise also has a malevolent spirit's attention for her attempted contacts at someone in her past who she lost. And in the process, this Quinn girl gets possessed, and Elise has to try and save her. And we delve back into the further as we had ventured in the first two movies.
Now, explain so the further.
Earlier, you said you loved the movie, like you really liked Insidious 3. What did you like about it, or the further?
Well, the reasons why I like Insidious 3 are the same reasons why I like all the movies, all the Insidious movies. You know, they're very simple. You know, as you mentioned, you know, earlier, you know, a lot of the special effects in this movie, they're very practical. They're not too in your face. They're not too. I don't think there was any, like, CGI, really. you know, maybe like little touch-up shots. But like a lot of the money shots, they were like, they were very believable. You know, it was just like it was very well done. And like as Lemongood previously mentioned, the slow build-up that's like, you know, that you see in all these movies, like that's something I really enjoy in a horror movie. Like I like jump scares, but for me, I'd rather just experience a slow build-up. Like for me, that's real horror for me. And I think these Insidious movies, they do the slow build-up really well.
And you mentioned the further. I think one thing that this movie has excelled at is creating some amazing. No, I'm using the word not amazing, but some fantastic bad guys.
Yeah.
That like they aren't jerks. They're just straight up evil, and they're scary. And they're bad business, and they just want death, and they want to hurt, and they want to consume, and they want to abuse, and they want to, like, they're evil. Like, these are really bad. Like, the red guy and Insidious, and then
The bride in black, yeah.
In quotation marks. And then in the third one, it's the man who can't breathe. And these are, like, you know what I love? You know, these are three original villains that are just bad news. Like, bad.
How bad are they, Mark? How bad are they?
They're really bad.
You know, I mean, I by the way, I completely agree. That is where this movie succeeded. That's where that's what gets me to like it, despite my problems with the story time. But please continue.
No, that red demon in the first one, dude, stressed me out. And then I remember Megan and I, we went and watched a second one, and I walked out of the theater with like my heart pounding, and I could barely sleep that night. Like, not out of nightmares, but I was so stressed. I was like legit like stressed out. And then the third one, like, dude, the third one, you know what I talk about with movies all the time? I cared for these characters. I cared for Elise, Tucker, and Specs. And like, even though that the family, like, they were a nice family, they were underwritten, but like, I kept thinking the dad, Dermot Maroney, I think, was gonna go, "Where are the pots? There's so many pots," and then the pots were gonna fall on him, like in that SNL skit. But like, they made a point. They even made his manicness, I think that's a word.
It is now.
His mania?
Yeah, his mania, like, seem legit, because she's like, ever since, you know, mom died, you've been living on chaos to kind of not think about her. And so even though the role wasn't handled entirely right, that's a cool point. And like, you're talking about the slow buildup, John. They had her walking, then they had her get hit by a car, then they had her stuck in bed with casts on her legs just for one amazing payoff.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that was such a brilliantly payoff scene. Talk about the scene, Mark. About the scene.
You do it, Levengood. You wrote about it. You loved it.
Okay, fine. So Quinn, this teenage girl, who appears to be the main protagonist in the trailers, I'll get to that issue later, but she is possessed at some point, or behaving in a possessed manner, and she gets up while she has her casts on, and she starts kicking them against her bedpost until they just start crumbling. But now it's not like two quick kicks and it off. It's off. This isn't like The Rock in the Fast and Furious movie where he just like hits his cast once and tears off the cast and it's
dramatic. Daddy's gotta go to work.
It takes her. She gives like 16 kicks. This is like Van Damme trying to kick down the palm tree in Kickboxer. Like, she's working at this thing all day, and her father and the paranormal investigator geek squad are sitting there terrified as she's got these white out eyes doing this. And then after they're off, after the dad is begging her not to do it, she starts walking forward. And even though, you know, she's possessed, that's the dad's saying, "No, no, honey, your legs." And she still walks forward and you hear the crunch. I was waiting to see protrusions in her leg, but I mean, it was just so twisted. It was so twisted. That was such a great scene.
And yeah. I love that, like, I like that all the different creatures in the further are different. Like, some want to escape and catch a bodily form. But this guy, the man who can't breathe in Insidious 3, just wants to collect people in his Holiday Inn Express nighttime. And, he just wants company to be his pets and to abuse. Like, misery wants company. And he is, like, just the biggest jerk, and like, oh, I love it.
I love it.
Okay.
Can speaking we, of jerks.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I'm good.
He literally, when he possesses Quinn, it is later explained to us by Elise, who evidently has a special device or power that we don't know about that gives her the ability to measure souls. Because the man who can't breathe literally stole half, and I'm quoting the movie, half of her soul, and he still wants the other half. And I'm just sitting back, like, I'm not a very spiritual person, but half a soul? Like, I was looking around at the people next to me in the theater, like, are we just going to let this fly? Like, no one's going to get up and yell?
So this is what I thought about. This is going to be really weird, but I think we'll relate. That movie Spring Breakers takes place in St. Pete. That's kind of where we all met.
Hey,
and a lot of Spring Breakers come into St. Pete, and like the local kind of like scumbags there, who are kind of like the man who can't breathe from Insidious, kind of try to take them into their world. They kind of take them half into their world, and like they want to get them fully. You know what I mean?
Are you comparing the Furter to St. Pete?
Well, no.
Only during spring break.
I mean, honestly, I agree with you in some parts of St. Pete. Well, probably most parts of St. Pete.
Yeah.
It gets so, pretty like, weird.
Like, you know how like people like take these nice people and they kind of take them into their world. So mm-hmm. these people haven't gone all in. They're kind of half experiencing it. And you know, some of them do eventually go all in, like in Spring Breakers. But some only get half and then they leave.
Yeah. All right, so all you folks listening who are not from St. Pete, be very, very careful when you're visiting St. Pete for the first time.
Things well, just get, for like spring break.
Yeah, it can get pretty dark.
I don't mean to sound mean, but I feel like this film had half a soul. I feel like, nice. So the two female actresses, I don't remember the name of the girl who played Quinn, but her and Lynn Shay who played Elise, so the psychic and the teenager, like, they were both very powerful roles, and they owned their roles. But I didn't really see a lot of development in the characters around them. Things just changed around them, and they just went along for the ride. But only those two characters, our two female protagonists, really seemed to do anything and develop. And then furthermore, I'm watching the movie, and I'm having trouble telling who the protagonist is. It's like a tag team where they take turns being the protagonists.
Well, and I totally agree. Because, those two ladies, like, you're really the only ones that get character development. But at the same time, it's like, was there really enough room for any more character development outside those two? Because it's a very quick movie,
really. That's the problem, though, is that they're shoving too much at us. They introduce us to this elderly woman and her husband, okay, but she played a key role. They introduce us to the boy down the hall because there was that knocking bit where she knocks on her wall and then he knocks back. Mm-hmm. But we never had to meet that physical character for that to work. So we meet the character in the beginning. We even meet his dad. And then later they're just gone. So we get all these characters to learn about, and then it doesn't really matter. It wasn't necessary.
The person who annoyed me the most was the landlord. When their ceiling cracks because of the man who can't breathe, so Dermot Mulroney and the super, they go upstairs and they're walking through this empty apartment, and the guy's like, yeah, there's nothing up here. And then they follow these bloody footprints under the bed right where the floor cracked. He's like, yeah, it's just probably some vagabond. And he's like, well, you gonna pay for this? And then like the super guy kind of gives like, ooh. Like, I'm like, who is this guy? He's the worst owner ever. So like that character bothered me. But Lynn Shay, though, is such Elise in the film. She's so great, man. Like, she's so nice. And she goes into the Further, even though there's this angry bride in black waiting to choke the living daylights out of her. But yet, like, and, like, she goes to bed every night with, like, her husband's sweater. And, like, she lives in this house where things just want to kick the living crap out of her. But she, like, has this heavy burden on her. And she keeps going through with it. And it's just like,
oh,
you know, and it leads to her demise in the second one.
She also has the best line in this movie. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? You guys don't remember the line she had when she was in the Further?
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to hear it from you.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, you know, near the end of the movie, she's going through the Further trying to save Quinn's soul. She meets the bride in black. The bride in black is choking her. And then, like, at least at this point, it's like, all right, I've had enough. Like, she pushes the bride off her. And then she stares down the bride and is like, bring it, bitch. I was just like, yes.
That's almost like a Sigourney Weaver Ripley callback.
I love that callback, though. I think it's great. Oh. I wish Charlize Theron and Mad Max would have said that to a Morton Joe.
It was just like, it was awesome. Like, she's like this sweet old lady just putting up all this bullcrap, and then they just see like a turning point in her character. Is like, all right, screw this. I'm just going to do what I got to do and get out of here. It was great.
I love it. And I was watching Insidious 2 again today, and some guy comes to her house, and they're like, I need your help. And so she's like, so you found yourself in over your heads, and now you're trying to bring me into it. And she keeps going along with it. Like, she's awesome. And like, but, oh, man, I hope they make an Insidious 3 with them, with her as a ghost. Because remember the end of Insidious 2 where she looks at that evil thing in the house, and she's like, she literally turns like a shade paler than pale. She turns like 50 shades paler than pale, and she's like, oh no. So like, if there's something that Elise says oh no to, I want to see this thing.
You know, actually
is it Kurt Russell from the Stargate?
Yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing more prequel chapters with Elise, Specs, and Tucker. Because the beginning of the movie states it was a couple years. It takes place a couple years before the first Insidious. So, I don't know. There's plenty of room for more stories for these three, right? I don't know.
No, and you know what? I'm always complaining about prequels with, like, Halloween and The Thing and all these crap sequels. But I'm talking about this sequel, and I want more. Like, I'm like, give me more sequels. And, like, I just love – I think there's a heart and soul to her. I think that she lives a life where she's just trying to help people, and it weighs on her. I love it. I love this movie.
Do you think filmmakers are regretting killing off Elise in the second movie?
Yeah. But like, oh man. So like this movie just gives me chills. Like I was reading the poster for Insidious 3 and it gave me chills. And legit, it like gave me chills.
Yeah, and it didn't say like this is how you die or something like that. Yeah.
Well, like here, let me pull up the poster here. Let's see here. I'm there. The man who can't breathe, the man who lives in the vents. I heard him saying your name last night. I heard him in your room while you were gone. He's in there right now, standing in your room. The hairs on my arm are standing up right now. I have like I don't know if you guys can see that on the camera. Yeah. You see it? You see it?
Yeah. I see it, Mark. I see it.
Wait, are you really scared, or do you just hairspray your arm? Just spray hairspray all over your arm?
Well, see, I knew I would do that, so I play the Insidious long game, and I just kind of set everything up in advance.
Okay. Smooth. Nice. I like it.
So, like, I mean, you mentioned, like, Lin Shaye. She's, like, the heart and soul. Like, and I she was amazing, and the girl who plays Quinn was very good. But, I mean, I think that they and of course all the creep factor, but the storytelling around it, I didn't really see a lot. I feel like it was just like connecting the dots between an intuitive. I almost want to use the word formula. I hate to be cliche when I'm knocking storytelling, but but the first movie, even though I wasn't thrilled with the storytelling there, that movie had a heart and soul. All the characters in the first Insidious develop with the story around it. It's got a good synthesis. And even though I feel like that was three different styles of story put together in the first movie, in the beginning it was like a home invasion, haunting, weird thing. The second part was almost like a la Poltergeist, figuring out what was wrong. And then the third part was this further adventure, right? That little horror story. But independently, each of those three sub-stories I felt was told very well. The synthesis was all wonderful. The scares were wonderful. The characters were wonderful. I gave a damn about everybody and everything. Even though, again, I whine about the storytelling because of the three parts, right? I always have to find something to whine about. Yeah. But the story brought nothing to me. It's like, look, here's Lin Shaye kicking ass. Here's this girl, Quinn. She's pretty good, too. They're both very strong female characters. They're good heroines in the movie. The guys are useless in this movie, pretty much. But whatever. I don't think that was an agenda. That's just the way it played out. But, like, around them, the things around them only mattered because of them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas the first film, it didn't need any one person to make it awesome. It was great. And in this one, I didn't feel that. This is my half a soul knock.
No, I get you.
super fun popcorn movie. I mean, all my complaints, if any of you actually read my review, like, it starts out, you'd think that I hate the thing, but then you see me come around a little bit, and it sounds like I'm whining a lot. But, I mean, I'm going to buy this on Blu-ray as soon as it's, you know, like, 10 bucks or under, you know, a few months after it comes out. And I'm going to watch it in the dark with my girlfriend, and we're going to love watching it. Yep. But it's not that movie where I sit back and talk about it later with my friends too much, unless we're podcasting. It's just a fun, scary, creepy movie for me. Yeah.
Hmm. And I love that all three of these films combined have cost $16.5 million, and they've grossed $323 million worldwide.
Is that Wan economics going
question.
On?
Oh, go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That brings me to a question, Mark, that I think you're going to be on top of. So these Blumhouse films, because this third one is still a Blumhouse production. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't the Blumhouse formula that they give you $3 million?
Yeah, but see, what they've done is it started with $1 million because the first Insidious was $1 million.
$1 million?
Yeah, it was the first one was 1.5. So people like the further was just, you know, then I think it looked amazing, but you could tell the budget limitations.
It
but
was
that helped
the
with
further.
The practical effects.
The further is supposed to be like the Netherworld, but basically it's like, oh, like here's the same hallway, but we'll turn the lights off.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the further.
Add some mist so the light can reflect off of it. Yeah. So, but so the first one was 1.5, and then what happens with like The Purge and Sinister and those kind of movies? Once that does really well, he'll up the budget a little bit. So, Purge Anarchy costs more money than The Purge.
Purge was a Blumhouse production.
Yeah. And then,
I can't even believe that. Wow.
Yeah, and so that started low budget, then it went more. So this one, the second Insidious, cost $5 million. And I think, you know, some of that probably went to the stars for coming back and everything. And Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne were great in those two movies. Great cardigans. And the third one, since I think, you know, the other two movies made $250 million worldwide, they upped the budget to $10 million for this one.
So, you know, it's interesting that the budget is so much bigger. But in all honesty, so I thought that the further, specifically in this third installment, Chapter 3 here of Insidious, I felt like that needed a broken leg cast. I thought the further was, other than the good creepiness and tone and build up and scares, but the further itself, I thought it looked horrible. Whereas in the first movie, maybe it's because they kept everything with less lighting, but in the first movie, I thought it was better. I thought it was more effective in the first movie and creepier on its own in the first movie. There's almost no budget.
Do you think it was creepier because we didn't know it the first time, and it was like this dad, Patrick Wilson, who had forgotten about that lifestyle, was going after like this incredibly evil red demon. So there was like a suspense involved. But in the third one, you knew that, you know, Lin Shaye was going to literally put, you know, people in headlocks.
Yeah, because like when you watch the first Insidious, when Patrick Wilson is going through the further, it's you didn't know what was coming. Like all you saw, he's just walking through the dark. They're like, oh, like here's his house, but like all the lights are turned off. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. But you watch Insidious 3 when Elise is going through, it's like you already kind of know what's happening. So it doesn't have that edge of mystery that the first movie
I'll
had.
Submit to the possibility that that's it. But if that is it, then the fault is even more on the filmmakers for not predicting that and making it different instead of just here's more of the further.
Well, yeah, the further didn't scare me in this one. Yeah. John, did you think the further? She had that lamp that was like a super lamp. I'm like, where did she get this?
Well, no, it's wasn't it part of her psychic powers or something?
Maybe.
That's what I thought.
No, maybe it's what like they should have done. You know, like when Neo was first in the Matrix.
Yeah.
Like he just showed up in his regular clothes, and Morpheus is like, "No, I imagine myself in this badass leather trench coat and these sunglasses, so I have them." Yeah. And then later, Neo starts looking cool once he gets a grip on it. So, you know, she's been in the further before. She's kicked off the training wheels. She comes in with some cool duds. I don't know where her leather trench coat is, and I don't know why she didn't upload some kung fu for that bride in black. But whatever, it's cool.
You know, when she confronts the man who can't breathe in the hallway in the further, and like I really thought like she's gonna go all Matrix. Like she's gonna when she ran towards him, I thought she could do like a jump kick, like kick him like 50 times in the chest.
And then pause in the air like Trinity does in her crane position.
She lands and she does the come hitter finger motion.
She has like a super punch or super push, Lin Shaye, in these movies. When she pushes something, they go flying.
Yeah. No, you don't want to mess with Elise when you're in the further. Yeah. So basically, if you're in St. Pete walking around at night and you see like a little old lady who looks like Lin Shaye, avoid her at all costs. Because you'll go flying.
And she went into the further with like a cute little scarf too, I think. Yeah. Like,
well, you gotta look stylish at all times.
That's right. Yeah, like I love her character. I do think that they were the heart and soul of this film. And there were moments that like really, like genuinely like moved me. The way like the sweater was there. Did her dog stay in the same place at all times? So that's one thing I worried about. Her poor dog.
No, the
Quint's... like the whole time she was gone. She never called the dog sitter.
That dog never moved.
I mean, Quint's mom when she appeared, like that was a pretty touching moment. I think I almost cried. I think I almost cried. Yeah.
I get legit welled up. Like,
yeah, like who's chopping onions in this theater?
Wait,
I'm trying to watch a movie here.
I'm not crying by Flight of the Conchords starts playing.
Yeah.
But like I don't know, I like that just we had this hero. I like that she does it when she doesn't have to. I thought the kid, you know, and you know what I think made this movie better was I've recently watched Annabelle and the Poltergeist remake.
Mm. Oh, yeah, of course, and me as well. And I thought that this movie kind of stumbled across the same snag as the Poltergeist remake, but it was saved by, again, well, this is a lot for a horror movie, but again, the scares and the tone combined with two powerful characters, whereas the Poltergeist remake, we never gave a damn about any of those characters, and so as a result, no matter how they did everything else around it, the buildup wouldn't matter to us. It was just wait until the next effect.
I sat there like Grumpy Cat watching Annabelle and the Poltergeist remake. But like with Insidious, I was the Paws jumping out of the water.
Yeah.
Happy.
No.
Hey, just a personal plug in case people have just started listening. We discuss Poltergeist remake versus the original in depth in our episode 17, and we discuss Annabelle and criticize the hell out of it in episode 4.
Wait, you have every episode like memorized? Because you said episode 17, episode 4. I'm like, whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, I still
I plug these things on Twitter a lot, so it starts to stick.
I still like my filing cabinet system.
Hey, John, what episode was that? Give me 2 hours.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, I think now will be a good time for me to kind of organize my filing cabinet a little bit more. But until I get some more files organized, let's take a quick break.
Hey guys, Mark here. And for you, the listeners of the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, today, since we're talking about Insidious, the prequel, we're talking about Jurassic World, the sequel, I want to tell you about the book called Dr. Sleep. It is the sequel to The Shining and written by Stephen King. And I had a great time reading it. It actually gave me nightmares one night, which made me look kind of silly. But it's a really good book about, the furthering of The Shining. So if you want to check this book out and to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Hey, podcast fans, I'm Jonathan, and I'm here to talk to you about an exciting new podcast brought to you by Shark Dropper Studios called Top 5. If you can think of anything and everything, guess what? We count it down from 5 to 1, reverse order. Me, Robert, John, you, your girlfriend, your mom, your dad, his dad, we count it down. Listen, Shark Dropper Studios, sharkdropper.com.
Welcome back to MFF. All right, so my filing system might be a little bit broken. I tried to open it, and it just collapsed. all the contents are on the floor now. Everything's a mess. I don't know what to do. There's like movie references all over the place.
So, dating back from the first episode.
Yeah. So, don't ask me for any more references.
I feel like you built a filing system out of cardboard boxes.
That's basically what it was. It was just cardboard boxes built on top of each other.
No, I have to bring John. You're recording in the dark right now. Are you going for something?
Oh no, I'm. I had a little after the little filing cabinet collapse. I was distraught, so I decided to do a little seance. to just kind of calm my mind. But I think I might have gone too far, and I'm now in the furter. So
wait, who are you going to seance to calm me down?
I was trying to call the ghost of Kurt Russell from Soldier after he got killed. Scorpion King Rock.
From Poseidon.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm kind of sitting here in the dark right now. I'll out the furter. It's kind of nice, actually.
Is it hot?
No, it's actually it's a little breezy. Actually, it's nice. Nice. It's getting a little drafty, though. Like, I'm not going to lie.
I haven't so there's the red man and the bride in black and the man who can't breathe.
Yeah.
What follows John, the evil spirit that caught John's attention?
Well, no, I mean, I see them both, but they're just kind of having like their own conversation in the corner.
I'm sending you a duckling that breathes acid gas. That's what's following you around. It's a little rubber ducky that breathes acid gas at you.
Yeah. So it's like is it like a cloud that if you touch,
no,
it's like the happening?
Yeah, like a corrosive miasma.
Like it's actually like right next to my foot right now, and it's just really smelly. It's just smell like it's just smells like someone's farting the whole time.
It melts off your leg with its.
I don't know. It's just so cute looking though. It's just like doing little wheezing, and it's just like expelling all that gas. It just smells like a fart.
You should put an air freshener. Put an air freshener on it.
Yeah, I don't know. The fur is a weird place. Don't visit. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, now that weird segment's over, Mark, I think you have another listener question from Donnie, right?
Yeah, and this one is from Donnie Brewski, a famed member of the Brewskis, who were the biggest band out of the Northwest before Nirvana came out.
Those, right.
Those bastards.
That lived at your house.
Yeah. And so this one is about very bad ideas. So he asks, how many times did Dr. Grant say Jurassic Park is a very bad idea? And the first thought that comes to mind is in Jurassic Park 3, when they land a plane and Taya Leone has a megaphone on an island full of dinosaurs and she's screaming into the megaphone and refuses to not speak on the megaphone. And Dr. Grant goes, that's a very bad idea. And then she turns around with the megaphone and goes, what? And then a dinosaur roars.
Okay. So I think of just Jurassic Park because the other movies I think I only ever saw once, parts 2 and 3. But like, pretty much, how many times in the movie did he have lines? That's about the number of times that he said that Jurassic Park was a bad idea.
Aside from when he told that kid about how raptors kill people, and then when he was resting on that brontosaurus belly.
He was
a strong, quiet guy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know what? I'm going to go with 0. I don't think anybody in charge of Jurassic World went to Dr. Grant at all. He was like, you know, whatever. I mean, he was there for like the first incident, but we don't really care about his opinion. Let's just like make like a whole. Let's just recreate the scenario, but with bigger and better or more dangerous dinosaurs.
And less park safety.
Yeah.
And less, considerably less.
And classified dinosaurs. But so I watched the movies again. And before Jurassic World, and I forgot how bad the decisions are. I love Jurassic Park 1. I will defend anything from that movie. It's perfect. But the second one, Julianne Moore, is this character that has spent her life studying carnivorous beasts that attack you and kill you, predators. And in Jurassic World, she makes the mistake of going up to a baby and like petting it and taking pictures with the parents around, which is a terrible idea. And then she takes a baby T-Rex into her caravan.
Yeah, and then the mother comes hearing its whining and just starts knocking the shit out of
it. But the whole movie, she's talking to Jeff Goldblum, and she's like, I can take care of myself. And it's like, no, you can't, lady. You're making terrible decisions.
Not only can you not take care of yourself, but you are untaking care of us, regardless of our wise decisions.
Listen, like Vince Vaughn is like, you've put my life in danger twice. You know, like, but so she's like, but the whole movie, they remind us on how, you know, but then like, I don't know. I do like when that T-Rex stomps on the guy in Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World. That's pretty cool. But, yeah, so I would say Dr. Grant said Jurassic Park is a very bad idea a couple times in the originals, and they never really cared about Jurassic World. So
well, this
they
is,
just shut him out.
Here's a question that I want to bring up. Like, how many times was Jeff Goldblum's character asked but by anything before they opened Jurassic World?
Well, they quickly learned that he'd never shut up, so they stopped asking him questions. He would just like interrupt with his ideas.
Yeah. Hey, life finds a way, guys. Life finds a way.
Yeah.
I love him in those movies. Dude, Jeff Goldblum is like the secret all-star to every film.
That's true.
I won't call him an all-star in The Lost World. He was an all-star in pretty much everything else he's done.
But Jeff Goldblum, action star. That's amazing. Right? Like, and I love the whole movie. He's like, guys, this is a terrible idea. The only reason I'm going here is to save my girlfriend who keeps putting herself in danger. And my kid stows away with us, and I got to deal with this. And now we're bringing a T-Rex back to New York.
I don't know. Like, Jeff Goldblum is just so neurotic, but also really confident at the same time. Like, it just shows in, like, the characters he plays. Like, it's just this weird combination of neurosis and confidence. Like, it just, no other person in Hollywood can do that. Like, it's weird. I don't know. Jeff Goldblum's, I don't know, he's a special actor.
His neurotic confidence.
Yeah. That's the best way I can describe Jeff Goldblum.
So he's like a larger version of Woody Allen from Annie Hall.
Now, if I had to describe Kurt Russell, I would say confident confidence.
Confident confidence?
Yeah.
Like, the only time I think he hasn't been confident is in Poseidon.
Like, I mean, you can be confident, but you're just like, it's a fake confident. But then there's a confidence where it's like, yeah, it's real. Like, there's no way anything can go wrong. Like, that's just Kurt Russell in a nutshell.
Like, so it's kind of, you know, I think to Kurt Russell, like, so Jurassic World kind of ignores 2 and 3. So Kurt Russell fans kind of ignore Poseidon.
Yeah.
There you go.
Actually, you know, okay, hold on. So what was the question again? How many times was Dr. Grant asked if Jurassic World was a bad idea, opening up Jurassic World?
So our answer, we slightly answer everything. So I'm going to say 6.
6.
I'd go more with like 86.
Okay.
All right, let's divide that. Lazareth, what do you got?
Hold on. Let me grab a sheet of paper here off the floor.
If you were to average that, you'd get 42.
I got my 6 plus 86. What do you say, Lazareth?
Yeah, you know, it's really dark in here. I can't really see. It's the further. I don't know.
Give us a number.
20.
20.
Okay.
That's right, probably accurate. That's probably the real number.
So 37.3 times.
All right.
So he went, I don't think that's a T-Rex, and then he runs away. So he didn't get to finish his sentence. So 37.3. Put it in the loose paper that's flying around, and we'll store it later. In a
I can just imagine the 0.3 of Dr. Grant going like, wait, how many times? Forget it. That was the 0.3. Like, that was the 0.3. Like, the 0.3 is when he gave up.
Or he's, like, in a T-Rex's mouth. Yeah. He's like, oh, forget it.
Forget it.
You know, so Jurassic Park, like, you defend everything to the death of that movie, right, Mark? Like, and I'm kind of in the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was talking on the phone with somebody and they were talking badly about Jurassic Park, I think I could reach through the phone and put them in a headlock.
Right.
Like you were in Kung Fury.
Yeah, exactly.
Through the phone. So, like, that movie, I cared about everybody in Jurassic Park. Even the characters who were meant not to like Wayne Knight's character, you like not liking them.
Yeah.
So you have a care and investment in every character. In part two, you care about who? Okay, well, Julianne Moore, she was cool until all of her bad decisions, but we kind of cared. And we care about Malcolm. We care about Jeff Goldblum. Vince Vaughn, just because he's Vince Vaughn and we saw Swingers. And so, like, we kind of care. He was kind of the quick-witted camera guy. We cared about them. They kind of built the world up a little bit, not like Jurassic Park, but, you know, the first one. But we cared about the bulk of the characters, even if it wasn't as powerful. And part three, we really just care about Dr. Grant.
Yeah.
Maybe Taya Leone, because she cares so much, even though she's crazy about it.
I just kept going, get Sam Neill out of this place. Get Dr. Grant out of here. Yeah, I just wanted him to escape and Jurassic, ugh.
Yeah.
But so But Taya Leone, though, she her character cared. It made me care. But William H. Macy was just taking up space. So I feel like that was down to two characters that I gave a damn about at all. Not even, like, really well, but at all. Jurassic World, Chris Pratt. That's all I got.
Yeah.
I kind of like that character with all the little dinosaur toys, but he was such a minor character that I don't want to count him. But, like...
He had my favorite lines in the movie. When you first meet him, he wears the original... He wears a shirt with the original Jurassic Park logo.
Yeah, and they're like, isn't that in bad taste? And, says, these things are really rare. I got it on eBay.
No, then he goes on, like, on a rant about, like, you know, the first park, you know, that was a great one. Like, it didn't need, like, all these, like, these bigger dinosaurs. Like, they had the originals.
Didn't everybody just, like, get eaten?
No, you know, like, it was a great, like, you know, like, that line was completely tongue-in-cheek. It's like they knew, it was like, yeah, this sequel's not as good as the original movie, but we're just going to run with it.
Yeah, but that's like saying Bill Murray was great in Charlie's Angels. When you're on for 3 minutes every 20 minutes, it's easy to have a couple good one-liners.
Yeah.
He was great. Bill Murray's great in everything.
He is.
He had a cameo in a tree in Get Smart, and I think he was the best part of that movie.
Oh. It's like, where are you going? Are you coming back? You're not coming back.
And his cameo in Zombieland was like the best part of that great movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, all right. So Jurassic World is about
Chris Pratt.
Yeah. So
yeah, Chris Pratt.
It's about the park's functional. And so the thing is, though, is that we aren't excited by dinosaurs. So they got to keep creating dinosaurs. So they genetically modify a dinosaur. And for some reason, they keep its ingredients classified.
Mystery.
And then the dinosaur escapes and everything goes bad.
Yeah, like,
so
the thing is, like,
talk about what they made.
Yeah.
Like, just the name and Indominus Rex.
Yeah.
Like,
it's kind of catchy.
I just want to call it Insidious Rex.
Insidious Rex.
Terrible.
Like, it's just, all right, so this movie, right? It's sitting here, you know, it's making all these jokes about, like, you know, it's talking about, like, how corporate greed is bad because companies just want to make more money. But it was basically just a big product placement thing for, like, Samsung, Mercedes, Coca-Cola,
yeah.
Beats by Dre, Starbucks, Margaritaville. So here it is, and it's like, people are greedy. And then everything in it is product placement. They made that Mercedes look like the greatest vehicle ever made.
Honestly, it felt appropriate somehow because we're making a movie about theme park. And you can't find any more product placement than a theme park, right?
And they even joked about product placement in the movie because of corporate sponsorship for exhibits. And they're like, what is it going to be, the AT&T-asaurus or the Verizon Rex or whatever?
But it's like, it's $190 million costing movie. Let's say $200 million. And, like, it is AT&T. So it's like, you know, making – it's saying – It's a $200 million movie that's saying corporate greed is bad, but yet we're cheeky enough to make this park seem like we're – it's a park with advertisements. So they're kind of pulling like a double on – like a flip on audiences. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It – I don't know. It's weird because it kind of had like self-referencing commentary, but it didn't really follow through with it completely. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, you know, we're making fun of these things, but we're still going to be – we're still going to be in a movie that we're making fun of right now. You know, like, if that makes any sense?
Yeah.
It just didn't have the balls to just kind of go through the joke.
Yeah. I wish it would have, but it didn't. Like, I think they wanted to get that out. I think it was almost too self-conscious.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is like a movie where no one's going to remember the characters. Like, Chris Pratt's one of the most likable dudes on the planet, so of course he'll come across well. But, like, the dinosaurs are the things that everyone's talking about, like the raptors. Like, everybody wants Blue the raptor. You know, like, that brontosaurus that died. Like, I think people felt more for that brontosaurus than any character in the film.
That was sad.
Yeah, see?
That was sad when
was that a puppet? It didn't...
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was about to say, like, it looked more real than all the other fake CGI dinosaurs in that movie.
Yeah, so the one puppet that they used looked more real than anything else.
It had more of an emotional impact than any other scene in the movie.
It's just, like, so we cared more about, like, oh, there's this scene, right, where the Velociraptors kind of pulled a double cross on Chris Pratt, spoiler, And then they're killing everybody. And then the raptor looks at Chris Pratt, who's the trainer of the raptors. And he goes, oh, hi, Chris Pratt. You know, we're buddies. And then a rocket launcher blows up the raptor. and I felt really bad for that raptor. And the funny thing is, in most movies, I'm like, why don't they use a rocket launcher? And they actually use a rocket launcher in this movie to blow up a raptor that I liked more than any human character in the film.
Good job, Mark.
Yeah. Wait. You brought up the raptors double cross, and it really seems just like that. They made in Jurassic Park a velociraptor clumsily, but with persistence, opens a door, and that was considered the holy shit moment of their intelligence, that it figured out how to clumsily open a door, right?
Yeah.
And then, and this though, excluding the fact that they're trained, like you would train, I don't know, a pack of dogs. Like, all of a sudden, they're communicating at a higher level than in the other movies. They're immediately recognizing some new species because it has Velociraptor DNA in it, as if it was their commander in chief, and they could speak clearly to it in a clear language. Because they just run up, they were trained to kill it, follow its scent. And then they look at it, and after a few sounds, they're just like, oh, well, we're going to go kill those other guys for you, Mother Indominus Rex.
Yeah.
And then later, like, they team up with a T-Rex, and after they fight with the T-Rex, they just, like, look at each other, the T-Rex and the Velociraptor, is like, yeah, we're cool, and they go in opposite directions.
Peace.
Like, mic drop. Like, there was... The intelligence that they gave these things was like that Hollywood recipe for bigger, more equals better, but it always fails.
Yeah.
Like that's what they did. They tried to supercharge everything. I didn't even want that.
And what annoyed me about it the most is like they pulled a Seinfeld and it just yada yada'd everything. Like they're like, oh yeah, we added some extra stuff to them. You know, like yeah. Like, that's what the scientist says. He's like, yeah, we just put some extra things in him. They, like, yada yada their intelligence. And, like, you know what annoyed me the most is this Indominus Rex. I'm just going to call him Rex. They're like, listen, we can't tell you what's part of this T-Rex. But people had died in these parks before. Why keep that classified? If I was a scientist that created Rex, I'd be like, listen, he can change color and he can and he
don't get your asses killed.
Yeah, he can change color and his body temperature can turn down. So if you ever at his cage and you can't see him in there, he's there. He's just messing with you guys. So just, you know, don't let him pull a quick one on you. Don't leave the cage completely unwatched and let him do some scratch marks. Come back and be like, oh, hey, he's gone. And then go inside the cage and let him bust out. Like, the whole thing is dumb. It's just dumb. Like, and don't get me wrong. You know, I had a smile on my face during the fights. And no, I didn't. And the whole thing annoyed me. Yeah. But it's just like, but why keep that classified after so many people died? Like they tell the scientists, make us a better dinosaur. Okay, this is what I'm going to do. Like, it makes the movie
You know, you referenced the scene that really bothered me so much also about the animal's intelligence is they later in the movie, after that, when they think that the Indominus Rex had escaped from its cage or whatever, and that's when Chris Pratt comes in for the first time there to its whatever holding area. Like, if they're their claw marks and they don't know it's there. They don't get the heat signature. So this thing, it's not like it just clawed and they thought it was gone. It clawed and then decided to suddenly change its body temperature, which it had never done before, clearly, because they would have lost track of it to a cold-blooded creature or something from warm-blooded or vice versa. So it decided to do that while camouflaging probably as well. But then later in the movie, even if we accept that it's that smart, possibly – later in the movie, they explain it's just discovering where it is in the food chain. The only relationship it has with the outside world is with that wire that brings it food on it, you know, like a side of beef. So it has no reason to even understand that it can do these things or that humans hardly even exist or that physical prey even exists, but it's going to pull this trick.
Yeah. I picture it going in the bushes going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
They're, like, they're not going to see me.
Like, oh, yeah, they're not going to see me. So, like, do they not have video cameras? It's like, hey, let's watch how this thing escapes.
They do, but, like, they're at angles where you can't see the dinosaur, apparently, making scratch marks on the wall.
So this dinosaur pulled a great escape, you know, watched Steve McQueen. They let the dinosaur watch movies, so he studied Steve McQueen and the Great Escape and figured out how to get out of this thing. But it's just like...
Maybe it doesn't like the classics. It's a new model. Maybe it was watching Schwarzenegger and Stallone in Escape Plan.
Yeah. Or Tango and Cash.
Tango and Cash. It was going through the Stallone filmography.
No, I was watching Gilmore Girls on DVD. It's going through the whole series.
And also Cliffhanger and Daylight. That was helping with like the climbing the wall stuff.
And Predator. So it can hide in the jungle. But
that's actually one thing that I wish they did. Like, why didn't... If it can detect dermal signatures, how come no one went the Arnold route in Predator? Just covered themselves in mud. Like, I half expected Chris Pratt to just be, like, shirtless and just covered in mud. Like, shooting like a machine gun. And then he talked
like this, like Adrian Brody did in Predators. Yeah.
I knew nothing Adrian Brody said in that movie. No. But,
I don't know. I think it's 70% on Rotten Tomatoes, and people are loving this film. It's made $500 million worldwide. It's the number one opening of all time. And a lot of people are like, it's a popcorn flick. Get over it. It's dinosaurs fighting. Get over it. I'm not going to get over it. Like, I'm not going to accept. I'm not going to accept Pacific Rim's wonky logic. I'm not going to accept that this dinosaur watched Escape Plan, scratched on a wall, hid in the thing like the Predator, and then waited for people to open up the cage door.
Well, you know, for all its silliness, for all the weird things that happen or stupid things that happen, Pacific Rim was much better written and had a story that actually mattered a little bit and had characters that developed other than the one star.
Yeah.
I mean, Blue the Raptor had more personality than these people. Like, Bryce Dallas Howard, I felt so bad for her. Like, I don't know if it's her as an actress or, like, she gets her old – the roles like Jessica Chastain turns down or, like – but in this movie, she's, like, running in heels the whole time. And, like, she's this career woman who's all business. She's bottom line. She doesn't have a kid or a boyfriend. And, like – and then she's all business. And then, like, they give her moments where it's, like, she does something good. And they're, like, hey, look, it's a woman who could do something good. And then they're, like – you know, she has this scene where she's, like, I'm ready to go. And then, like, it's just not good. It's not, like – that her character is so underwritten. And, like, Laura Dern in the first one was awesome. Like, she was, like, an equal to Dr. Grant. You know, even Julianne Moore could, like, survive on her own, even though she made some bad decisions. Like, but at the end, she was still down to go, like, get the T-Rex and get him back in the cage.
And she was wearing her work boots and running. She had good tread. She had good tread on it. She was sprinting like Matt Damon in the Supremacy movies.
Yeah. And so, I actually had no problem with the heels because Bryce Dallas Howard even said, you know, I didn't want to run on the terrain barefoot, so I stuck with the heels. So that's their decision. That's fine. But, like, I don't know. It just wasn't – her character was underwritten. You had the kids in danger. They were underwritten. You had a snooty assistant that got wiped out brutally. That was underwritten. And then, like, Chris Pratt, when he was, like, hitting on her, like, that was weird. Like, he's like, hey, you want to come in my bungalow and discuss things? Like, what?
Well,
like,
I think that was just Chris Pratt, like, being Chris Pratt. Like,
yeah.
You know,
like, whatever. Yeah,
and that was actually not a written scene. That was just him hitting on her. That was the first scene they did together, and they were just like, "Let's run with it. It's good."
And I've had my qualms with that stupid sea beast and how easy it can get over the barriers, and it was proven. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Obviously, it's not the best Jurassic movie, but I think the reason why it's doing so well because it broke box office records. Right, I think the reason why it's doing so well is because it plays a lot on the nostalgia of the first movie. Because there's a couple moments in the movie where it plays off the first movie. You know, when those two kids they stumble across the original visitor center, you know, and when you open up the doors, you see like nature's reclaimed it. I'm just like, oh, that's from the first movie, and you see like the jeeps and like that was really well done. And for me, like, yeah, I thought it was really cool, like, at the end.
Also copied, too, though. I mean, those same kids, they went in that little, like, that glass pod vehicle. Yeah. That was, like, when the kids were going on the tour before things went wrong in the Jeeps. And then Indominus Rex is cracking down on the glass with the kids underneath it. That was just, like, the T-Rex pushing down on the glass, sunroof with the kids in it in Jurassic Park. They copied a lot of stuff, too.
And they were pawned with somebody that didn't want to be with them because Dr. Grant didn't like kids and that snooty British assistant didn't like kids.
But, yeah.
Like, and that British assistant, what a wash. They should have eliminated that character altogether. That was stupid.
Yeah, why was she in there? I don't know.
So, someone wrote this about the movie. There's I think they said Jurassic World really wants to be the next Jurassic Park, but there's a key difference. While Jurassic Park played off of our love of dinosaurs, Jurassic World plays off our love of Jurassic Park. The Business Insider wrote that. Perfect. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to say the big difference is, and I agree with everything you just said. I'm going to say that the big difference is that Jurassic World, the writers didn't realize that cell phones could text. Because, and my girlfriend said this, and I didn't even think of it when we were watching the movie together. When the aunt, when Bryce Dallas Howard is calling her nephews, when they're kind of off the grid, when the tragedy is striking, and they should bring their little glass pod back, they're getting bad reception. My girlfriend looks over at me and just says, "Just text. The signal will intermittently go through the moment that like they could have been texting the whole time, even if there was a little delay on the communication." And I just look at her. It's like, this is why I love you. But I mean, it's so true, though, like the idiotic moments and the assistant, the British assistant, she loses the kids. And then it's not until what might have been an hour later after they get over to the pod area and get in the pods and they're going way off the grid through some broken fence. Well, all that time, the British assistant didn't text or email or call Bryce Dallas Howard to let her know. Like, it's not until the shit hits the fan and she's like, "Where are the kids?" And the alarm's going off and she's like, "Oh, I lost them a while ago."
Whoops. Yeah, it was just – and then I don't think that one kid would allow his brother to go off track. Like, that one kid was really smart. And then the older brother, there's that creepy scene where he was, like, staring at those girls.
Dude, that kid, he's a future roofie user.
Like, he was just staring at those girls, and they were kind of, like, uncomfortable. They're like, licking his chops. This is weird. This is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe. I don't know, but you know that scene where Bryce Dallas Howard is driving and the kids are in the back of that van when the raptors do the double cross and she hurts one of the raptors? And I was like, no. this movie's meant to sell toys. Like, they gave the raptors names in different colors because they're going to sell all four separately.
Hmm. You know? Yeah, that's a good point. You know,
I got Alpha Blue and Red. I need Code Blue. I need Code Red. Wait, that's a Mountain Dew. But it's I like that spit dinosaur appearance. That was a good callback to Jurassic Park.
That was a great that was tasteful and creative the way and they used it well. It was a good device. Yeah, that was perfect.
You know what? It just made me miss the dinosaurs from the first movie.
Yeah.
As you mentioned in that quote previously. The first Jurassic Park movie was all about the dinosaurs. So when you see, like, these callbacks, like, the final scene, like, the final battle scene between the Indominus Rex and Bryce Dallas Howard runs off to, like, to get help, so to speak. Like, I kind of got chills when I slowly realized, like what she was going to do. Like, she was, like, getting the T-Rex out. I'm like, oh, you're getting, like, the original bad guy, the original king of dinosaurs to take out this new pretender to the throne. It was, like, this cool little... King Kong Godzilla moment. I'm just like, come on, kill him, T-Rex.
Yeah, you're right.
That was actually a cool moment. I'm just like, that was like, I don't know. I mean, it's definitely a play on nostalgia. It was definitely cheesy, but I don't know. It was really exciting to watch like the old T-Rex just like go on the battle like this new, fake raptor guy, Indominus Rex. I don't know.
Yeah, kind of like a beat up the pretender.
And
yeah.
You know what, though? As cool as that was, like everything else in this movie, it was rushed. They mm-hmm. rush into the catastrophe instead of world building like the first Jurassic Park did to get us to love and care. And then it's like, hey, let's just get the T-Rex. Here's a flare. Run down the hall. Boom. The T-Rex is fighting. It was rushed.
Yeah.
It was cool. I agree. It was cool. But it was rushed. Everything was forced.
It just everything about this movie just made me... miss the first Jurassic Park. I'm like, there's just that magic with the first movie that just apparently no one can ever recreate again.
And I'm not sure why the critics gave it 70%. This is kind of like the same thing about that amazing Spider-Man remake by Mark Webb and Andrew Garfield. Like, they got positive reviews, but every positive review was like, yeah, I mean, for a popcorn flick, it's good. It has its faults, but there's dinosaurs. Like, all the positive reviews are like, yeah, it's got dinosaurs. But, like, I don't know if that should be – I know it's a popcorn film, and it made a lot of money. So, I mean, someone even called it critic-proof, which is true. I mean, no matter what we say, people are going to watch it. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Do you think,
I don't know.
Do you think
I wish I could have taken out my brain to enjoy it, guys. I love Battleship. I'm an unabashed lover of Battleship.
With Liam Neeson?
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I just couldn't take my brain out for this film. Because, I don't know, I guess it has the Spielberg pedigree. Like, when I watch a this is going to sound weird. When I watch a Transformers film, right, I know it's going to be crap. So I'm able just to, like, sit back and watch 2 hours, way too long, 3 hours of stupidity. And, like, not hate it, you know? Mm-hmm. But when I think about the brand of Jurassic Park and the first one and, like, how good it is, it just pains me because this movie was just basically saying, hey, the first one's better, and we're just going to remind you of the first one,
yeah,
and you're going to love it. Is that, you know what I mean?
It just,
I mean, yeah, this new one we talked about, that Brontosaurus dying scene, that was the one, I want to say one, I think, in the whole movie, the one emotionally powerful scene.
Yeah.
And we know we talked about this with Spielberg's involvement in Poltergeist as well. But, like, Poltergeist was very powerful throughout the film. Different levels of emotions were tapped. In the first Jurassic Park, we felt innovation. We felt enlightened by some of the practicalities that Dr. Grant is telling us, or the warnings of Malcolm. We feel touched when we see the sick Triceratops. We feel truly scared for the characters later. It was emotionally powerful across the board. And in this... again, one powerful scene that's, you know, 2 minutes.
Yeah. Is it really unfair? Is it unfair, you think, to compare all these sequels to original movie? Because the original movie, you had the trifecta of Michael Crichton as the writer, John Williams as the composer, and then Steven Spielberg as the director. I mean, you can't get better than that as far as filmmaking goes. It was just... it's hard to top that. Like, yeah, like all these brilliant minds working together to create this one amazing movie.
You know, John, you can say that, and it's fair to say. And also, that was when the world was built. The first Harry Potter is always more magical because we were introduced to the world. The first Matrix is the one that shocks us the most because we discovered what the Matrix was. But at the same time, as said, they rushed in. They didn't give us character development. It's one thing to say it doesn't have the magnitude because of all this other stuff, but they're phoning it in.
Yeah. So if they had sort of a proper script, so to say, with actual character development and also more practical effects, because the first Jurassic Park movie looks better than this one.
Still. Yeah.
So if they had like the same level of effects, do you think it would have been a wordy
successor? I think it had the potential to be very worthy, but obviously not as powerful as the original when we saw it. But, you know, let's talk about the side plot too. This thing with Vincent D'Onofrio where the secret plot to militarize the velociraptors and the dinosaurs, which, by the way, felt an awful lot like the undertones of the Alien franchise with utilizing cloning, training the aliens across the movies. But that aside, like, this whole subplot that's happening, it was absolutely unnecessary. Almost all the same things, training them, using them to help fight the Indominus Rex, them being genetically modified to entertain people, all those things could have existed without that militarization thing. And all the time Vincent D'Onofrio was there, I'm just annoyed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kept thinking about him from Daredevil and how much better he was in that. But, like, I think each raptor probably costs $100 million, right?
About, yeah.
All right. So for the military to take dinosaurs and shrink them into little, like, compies, those little compisauruses, but raptors would probably cost $250 million. Then you got to train them for 20 years. Right. And then you got to build an army of thousands, which is probably, you know, $1 trillion. Then you need trainers, and then you put little cameras on them. Right.
And those aren't cheap either.
Which, by the way, with the cameras on them, again, a callback to Aliens when Apone and Wierzbowski and all those colonial marines are getting killed. Like, they go offline with the camera.
Yeah. It's just like, how, like, you drop them off? Do you take their train? Are they like dogs that, like, you know, like the dogs that have their trainers with them? Do you take like a little raptor with you? Mm. Like,
well, with how smart these things were, you could have given them like a you could have debriefed them pretty much.
So they're sitting in chairs, like on Top Gun, getting debriefed. And there's like
their legs are crossed. They have a dossier. Like, they're figuring shit out.
There's like the hotshot Iceman and Maverick.
One
and all
of them's smoking a cigarette. The other one's like drinking a coffee.
Yeah. Wait, I want to see a Raptor drive a Ford F-150 Raptor and then fly in a Raptor plane.
Man, I'm pretty sure there's a picture down there in that somewhere.
But like, it's just, that's a terrible plot. And you're right. Like, there's only four Raptors right now. And that one guy's like, we're going to shrink them down. Like, that's like 20 years, guy. Like, that's like legit 20 years. And like, it's such like an implausible thing. Like,
but they did, well, they, you know, one sentence, right? But they did say that they did something to increase their growth rate significantly. And they commented that the Indominus Rex was very young.
Oh, they yada yada'd it?
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, the Genesis who did that? So that's the only character that returned from Jurassic Park. And in Jurassic Park, when they were in the egg hatchery and he was explaining it was a velociraptor that was hatching, he's this kind, sweet geneticist who really seems to care and has a passion for everything. And then all of a sudden, with no explanation as we skip forward, now he's this bottom line guy. He's like, I'm not telling you anything about my Indominus Rex. It's a secret. And then later, Vincent D'Onofrio is calling him. Like, they're in 100% cahoots. They're like, okay, protect the embryos, you know, let's get them out, just like Wayne Knight in Jurassic Park. Like, he went from this the humble playing God role, where he was just, you know, amazed by his creations and he loved them, to someone who was manufacturing, you know, kill bots and iRobot.
Yeah, and like, but why not tell? And that, you're right. And like, he was, I feel like he should have been twirling his mustache and he was like all smarmy.
Stroking a white Persian
raptor. He had a mini triceratops with him.
I just hated the fact that he was always sweating.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not blaming him, but it was just like, you know, dude, you're like in the tropics and you're wearing like pants and you're not exactly in the best shape. Maybe you should just like wear some shorts or something. I don't know. You look like you're struggling here.
Wear some cargo shorts, D'Onofrio.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. I'm still mystified why they wouldn't be like, hey, you know, if the heat sensor turns off in the cage, just like, don't worry about it. He's in there.
Oh my God. Stupid call number 46 of this movie with the heat. Indominus Rex, it sees with like kind of like infrared, like heat vision, right? And they were commenting that it was every time it killed, it was moving closer to where all the attractions were and all the people were, as if it could see this heat signature. I don't care if there are 20,000 people there, from 10 miles away. Yeah. Like, it's like through the tree, even if it could, let's just say because of all the CO2 emissions, right? Like a big city. But it's seeing this like through all the trees and just like it knows where to go to get to the human buffet.
This movie was not thought out. And then like the owner who can't fly a helicopter, he of course takes a helicopter out.
Like I thought it was hilarious that he just flew the helicopter to his death. Like he just crashed into that avian avian building. I'm just like, oh,
the life of Pi was abruptly interrupted.
But like I don't know, it's just, yeah, and then those birds come out, they attack people, and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. Hold on, was it me? Now, I don't know if I'm crazy here. I don't know all of my flying dinosaurs, like the expert kid in the first Jurassic Park, but there were pterodactyls, and then there were things that looked like pterodactyls with T-Rex heads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess they've been yada, yada-ing them.
Yeah.
But, like, that head must have weighed more than all the rest of the body. It was this huge, like, King Koopa head on this tiny little body with these little bitty wings snapping at someone. I don't know how it was holding that head up without falling over. It was just huge. It was like a bobblehead.
I like to see it fly really goofily. Like, just give me that at least.
Well, it flies instead of like the tail end hanging where the legs are and everything and all that weight is. It's hanging like forward with the head. Like, it's got a. It's almost like a bird lifting something that's too heavy for it. you need two of them, like two birds holding a coconut to fly with it,
or like that British assistant. Like that British assistant, right?
Yeah.
What I thought was hilarious is that British assistant had like a really prolonged, extracted, like death scene. She gets picked up by the flying dinosaurs, but then she gets dropped into the water.
Was wonderful.
But did you hear her on the phone? She was like, "Yeah, my fiance's not having a bachelor party because he's not doing that." Like, it's like, yeah, we know she's terrible. Like, you know what though? Like, her boss is probably a pain in the butt, and her boss probably forgot about these kids, and she and this assistant probably has to do everything. She's like, hey, watch my two kids who will listen to nothing you say, and are just gonna run ahead of you at every turn. Like, she got a bad rap, maybe. Do you think she got a bad rap?
No.
Oh, okay, never mind.
I think she was terrible. Again, she didn't even text her boss after she lost her kids for 30 minutes after the alarms went off at the park.
Hey, no one texts in this park. I think we established that.
I will say the one cool part, though, is when Chris Pratt is on a dirt bike and raptors are running next to him, he kind of smiles a little bit. He's like, I'm on a dirt bike and I'm riding around with war raptors. Like that, and he had a smile. I was like, all right.
I think kid had a pretty appropriate line, like, your boyfriend's a badass.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That was cute. It was cliche, like an Arnold Schwarzenegger one-liner, you know, action movie thing, but it was cute.
So would you guys say this description is accurate? Jurassic Park was all about the wonder of dinosaurs. Jurassic World was all about the wonder of Chris Pratt.
Yeah. Yes. This is Pratt World or Jurassic Chris. Or...
Jurassic Pratt. No, this is basically
living
just
in a world with Insidious Rex.
This is another starring vehicle for Chris Pratt. That's what it was.
Yep.
It wasn't a Jurassic Park sequel. It was just another Chris Pratt movie, which isn't a bad thing, you know.
Yeah, the dude is just likable.
Yeah,
and despite the things that we pan about this movie, it was still a fun movie to watch. And this is still just going to springboard him into roles like Indiana Jones. That's all over the internet, you know.
Or the next Jurassic Park movie. Why not?
Yeah.
That too. Oh, you know, people are saying that, like, fan theorying that Chris Pratt in this movie is the fat kid that, you know, was talking to Dr. Grant at the dig site in Jurassic Park.
No.
Oh. And like,
oh, no, I've seen lots of articles out about it. But the only reason that they're saying it is because at one point, after the attack site at the pod, he picks up an Indominus Rex tooth and is holding it up looking at it. And, you know, they're thinking of the vision of Sam Neill holding the Velociraptor claw in front of the kid's face.
It's a nice theory. The only flaw is that the writers aren't that deep.
Well, the only thing is that there were actually no clues, no facts that could be connected other than like, oh, he's wearing clothes. That kid was wearing clothes. It must be the same character. Like,
everything goes back to Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
That's right. All paths lead back to Jurassic Park. Right. But I mean, at the end, I don't know if you guys have any other really big points to make, but I think that this was a very fun movie, even when I was rolling my eyes at it.
So basically, it gave you the same reaction that Insidious Chapter 3 did. You were having fun, but you were rolling your eyes.
That's right. They rushed into it. In this case, one very strong character, right? But still, the strong character was cool. And then the big effects, like Kaiju versus Jaegers, it's fun to watch, even if the buildup isn't appropriate. And,
yeah.
I didn't like it. Maybe I'm jaded. But, like, it just kept me rolling. I just kept rolling my eyes. Like, I don't know. It just wasn't – I think everything happens because such terrible decisions were made. I never got into it.
You wanted another Jurassic Park.
I want another Deep Blue Sea. This movie is Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
All right. So
Deep Blue Sea was better.
No, what I'm saying is – all right, so Thomas Jane is, you know, the Chris Pratt character.
Okay, sure.
Saffron Burroughs is the Bryce Dallas Howard character.
Right.
All right, there is the investors, who's Sam Jackson, and then that's that con guy. They both die. Both the like guys who can shut it down die. All right, a helicopter crashes, right? Helicopter crashes.
Yeah.
All right, this Indominus Rex tricks people to keep opening up the park and doing things. The sharks trick people to get the thing to sink so they could get out of there.
It hurts them.
Yeah, it hurts them. This Indominus Rex tricks them. You know, it is. Oh, there's a scientist that gets his arm bit off. Mm-hmm. A scientist got his arm bit off in the first one. No, never mind. But this Jurassic World is Deep Blue Sea, but Jurassic World's trying to be smart.
Which is a mistake.
Yeah.
But Deep Blue Sea was smarter.
Yeah. I mean, there's no great deaths like the Samuel L. Jackson death.
So they should have just went full camp with it. Like, just full cheesy, just full campy. Like,
yeah, like, don't try to be smart and not be. Don't go. They dipped their toe in too many different things, and it just came across as a bland blockbuster.
Yeah. You know, my colleague, Robert Lamb from Shark Dropper, I think he described it best. Jurassic World hurts because it was just so close to being a great movie. It did a lot of things right, but it in general, it just failed.
Really. Yeah. It was there. It just didn't happen.
It was there. I don't know. It's still fun, though. Plus, it still has Chris Pratt with those dreamy eyes of his. I don't know. All right, guys. Well, I think it's time to wrap up this podcast. I don't know. Before we sign off, though, do we have any plugs to make?
Read the website, www.moviesfilmsandflicks.com. And go to Shark Dropper. Check out their wonderful shows. And John Levengood has a Kickstarter. He's going to be directing a movie about a guy who surfs while watching Hellraiser 3.
Screw that. I'm doing the Predator remake with Arnold and Danny Glover.
Oh, yeah.
That's I've already pledged $5.
Our What If podcast, guys. What if does Jack Barton pay his parking tickets?
Right.
But, yeah, so pay attention to his Hellraiser DVD watching movie. And that's my plug.
Cool, guys. Well, for my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
I got a song for you.
All right.
You want to hear it? I'll give you one line.
Okay.
This is a Brewski song that never got released, but it's about a guy who drank another guy's juice, and the other guy's really annoyed by it. So here's the guy. He goes, I drank your cranberry. And then the guy goes, that's unnecessary.
That song never got released.
That's like the Salacious Crumb responding.
I drank your pomegranate.
That's like $10.
I drank your pineapple.
That was my urine sample.
John Levengood somehow tried to follow that up.
Good evening, folks.
I like it.
I'll just say thanks to a handful of people who very aggressively promote our material on Twitter. Crash Palace, another podcaster. Vile Reviews, they have a podcast as well. Rivers of Gru, Keeper of the Quill, they're very helpful. And Trash Film Guru and Vix Movie Den. They will retweet anything that we ever do. We're very grateful, and they're also very talented.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for that, guys.
Donnie Brewski.
Yeah. Thanks, Donnie, for those excellent questions. Also for helping us bring out the old Mitch Brewski stories. That's always fun. Hey, maybe Mitch Brewski will make an appearance in the next episode, too. We'll see.
Oh, yeah, baby.
All right, I've been your host, John Lossler. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you guys next time.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! 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 This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.